content, but we certainly had a mind full of afflictions. Okay, so let me give another example. Let's say that I want my family to be well off, to have some more money than they have, and I have a position in a company whereby I can embezzle a little bit of money, you know, 10,000, 20,000, that's just a little bit for a company because they rip people off anyway. Yeah, and they're not paying me what I deserve. So if I embezzle some amount of money, it's not really anything negative because they should have been paying it to me in a salary. Okay? So you see the greedy mind and how it makes up this whole story about how what I'm doing is right. So I go and embezzle the money. You know, now my family has more money. I feel very content, very happy. The family's happy. Yeah, and my life goes on. Now, if I don't see what I did as something negative, yeah, and that actually my mind was full of afflictions and that what I did damaged somebody else, then I'm not going to purify. Yeah. So it's when I realize, oh, I had a very greedy mind that made up this whole story, and that what I thought what I was doing was for the benefit of my family, and actually it harmed other living beings because that money did belong to somebody else. It didn't belong to me. Yeah. So therefore, I need to change my attitude towards whoever it was I harmed. In this case, I had, in the example of greed, I had an attitude of complete apathy towards the beings who harmed. You know, like the guy Bernie Madoff, we were talking about him. I don't think he said, oh, I really want to harm all these people by taking all their retirement money or whatever it was. I don't understand the thing properly. But, you know, I don't think he said, oh, I really want to harm all these others. He was thinking, I want to have some extra money. Yeah, and I want to feel really good about myself for, you know, really being able to finagle this whole thing and, you know, be a little bit richer and people will respect me more. And, yeah, he probably had that kind of attitude, just like what we do when we're full of greed. Yeah, and so we make up some kind of story. You know, they won't miss it anyway, you know. Nobody will find out about it. Somebody else will fix it up. Yeah. So we have that kind of thing. So our initial attitude is one of apathy. Yeah. Kind of just careless neglect of others. No consideration for the effect that our action will have on others. Okay. So we need to change that attitude towards whoever it was we harmed in order to do the purification. So in the case of this example of greed, we have to see, oh, there are real sentient beings who are going to experience loss due to my action. Yeah. Whether or not I get enough money in my salary, that doesn't really matter. That's not the issue. That doesn't play in. The issue is I took something that didn't belong to me, that belonged to others, and others will feel the harm from that. Okay? So I need to change my attitude and care about these other people. They may be strangers. You know, I don't know them. That doesn't matter. They still have feelings. They want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. Okay, so we generate an attitude of love and compassion towards them. Now, even an attitude of bodhicitta, saying I want to become a Buddha for their benefit, so that in the future, instead of, you know, embezzling their money, I can lead them to enlightenment. Yeah, okay. In the case of anger, if I was retaliating against somebody who harmed me, again, I need to let go of that anger and forgive the other person and develop, you know, an attitude of compassion for them instead of that attitude of vengefulness and anger. Yeah. And then when I do, then that will help me to purify. Okay? So you see, changing my mental relationship with whoever it was that I harmed. Okay? In the case, so we usually harm either sentient beings or holy beings. Okay, so what I described was towards sentient beings. Towards holy beings, yesterday I was talking about it, taking stuff that belongs to the three jewels, be it offerings or maybe, you know, I feel like eating those oranges, you know, they need to come down anyway, I'll take them. Or, you know, somebody's offered a necklace to the three jewels. Well, you know, what's doing on a Buddha statue doesn't do any good there. I might as well have it. Yeah? Or you know, speaking poorly about our spiritual master and or criticizing the Buddha Dharma Sangha. Like, all this Buddhism stuff is just a bunch of idol worship. What are those people doing anyway? You know, they're looking at their belly button. Why don't they get a job and make some money and do something useful? Yeah. Ever heard that story? I've heard it a lot. Yeah. And so, you know, then realizing, oh, I had a harmful attitude towards the Buddha Dharma Sangha, and I need to, you know, change my attitude, repair my attitude. And in the process of doing so, that helps me have some regret because I see I had a wrong attitude to start with. Okay? Yeah? So this power of reliance, you know, at the beginning when we're taking refuge and generating bodhicitta, that is how we are changing our attitude towards whoever it was that was the object of our harm. So in the case of holy beings, instead of, you know, taking their stuff or being angry towards them, we take refuge in them. We seek their spiritual guidance. In terms of sentient beings, instead of disregarding their feelings or being angry at them or whatever, we generate bodhicitta based on love and compassion. Okay? So at the beginning of every sadhana we do, or every practice, no matter what you're doing, you always start out with refuge and bodhicitta. So you're always doing this practice of the power of reliance. In other words, relying on the ones that we harmed, we're now going to cultivate a different attitude and come out of what we did. Okay? Communicating? You know, there's been a story that's been going through my mind since the retreat, and I thought to share it with you. It actually started out from somebody. Well, I was at a leading a retreat in Mexico, and a woman came to see me. This was some years ago, and her brother was a priest. And the whole family, you know, was Catholic, had a lot of joy that, you know, he was a priest. And so he, you know, she had a son, and so she wanted her brother to, you know, train her son in Catholicism and everything. And, you know, so they developed a close relationship. When her son got into his 30s, it came out, he told her, that her brother had been sexually abusing him during this time as, you know, when he was supposedly tutoring him as a child. So this woman was just beside herself, you know. She was so upset that her son had experienced this harm. And she was so angry at her brother because she loved her brother. She trusted her brother. And for him to do this to his own nephew was just inconceivable to her. So she was very, very upset, very, very angry. She came to talk to me, and, you know, we talked some about it and about, you know, trying to forgive him and, you know, get over her anger. And, you know, she was very unsure what to do because her mother was still alive. And if her mother found out that her brother had did this, the mother probably would have just, you know, what a way to end her life to hear that her son was sexually abusing her grandson, you know. So she was very unclear about what to do. So we talked some about it. And then some years went by, and then I went to that area of Mexico again to teach. When was it? Maybe a couple of years ago or a year ago, something. And I went, and she was there. And so we were talking, and she told me that she went to see Lama Zopa and explain the situation to him. And Rinpoche said to her, go apologize to your brother. And she's going, Rinpoche, maybe you don't understand the story. It was my brother who harmed my son, you know. It was my brother who did the harmful thing, that he's the one who needs to apologize. And Rinpoche said, you need to apologize to your brother. So this is kind of like a Zen koan, isn't it? Yeah. So she goes away, and she's going, what in the world is he saying to me? And so some time goes on. She doesn't go and apologize to her brother because she doesn't understand for what, you know? And after some time, she acknowledges that she has a lot of hatred and anger towards her brother. Yeah? And that regardless of what he did something harmful, he did something inappropriate. But that doesn't remove the negativity of her anger. Yeah. In other words, we may be right, but that doesn't mean we're virtuous. We may win an argument. It doesn't mean we created virtue. Okay. So she started to look at how much anger she and hatred she had towards her brother. And she did go to him, and she did apologize for her anger because she saw that that was her part of the situation. Yeah. She was kind of hoping her brother might apologize too at the same time. He didn't. Okay. This guy clearly has some difficulties, some problems. But she apologized for her part. Okay? And did her, you know, the purification she needed to do so that she could be free of her anger. Because justified or non-justified, when we hold a grudge, we are in pain, and we are having a non-virtuous mental state, accruing negative karma. Okay? So I thought it was quite remarkable, you know, that she was able to do this and to get beyond the whole thing of, you know, I'm right, and he needs to apologize. And, you know, and release her anger. And I think this is, you know, one way that we sometimes get stuck in terms of harmful situations that have happened to us is we think that the other person needs to apologize first before we can let go of our anger. Yeah. Until they acknowledge that what they did destroyed my life, I can't forgive them, and I won't forgive them because they are wrong and they deserve my anger. That's the way our mind thinks. Who suffers? We do. Other person's off drinking tea, out with his friends. You know, they don't know that we're sitting there stewing in the middle of our anger and hatred. All those negative feelings, we are the victim of it. And when we say, I can't forgive until they apologize, we are giving up our power. We are making ourselves into a victim. No one else makes us into a victim. We make ourselves into a victim because we give away our power by saying, I can't be free of my horrible emotions until they apologize. And how are we ever going to control them and make them apologize? How are we ever going to do that? We can't make them apologize. We can't make them acknowledge what they've done. We can't crawl in their mind and rewire a few things. They're going to do what they're going to do. Okay, and we have to be able to make peace with it regardless of whether they apologize or not. Now, of course, we all have our daydream of the light bulb going on one day, you know, like, oh, I see, I hurt that person's feelings so much. I did something so inconsiderate, so terrible, so harmful. I feel terrible about it. And then they call us up and they come over and they're on the floor, groveling, walking towards us, rolling in agony, saying, please forgive me. I destroyed your life. I made you so unhappy. Please forgive me. You know? And then we can sit there and say, well, I'm glad you finally realized it. After all I've been through, the pain and anguish that you've caused me, I want you to rot in hell. What are you doing apologizing now? Go to hell and get out of here. Okay? Yeah? We have this kind of visualization. We're very good at visualizing. You know? This is the kind of visualization we do. Huh? Kind of our own internal drama. You never thought you had creative writing abilities. You do. Yeah? And we have this whole visual, you know, and then finally after they come, maybe 7, 8 times, begging our forgiveness, then out of the goodness of our heart, because we are superior beings. Buddhists who practice love and compassion. Then we can condescend to forgive this slob. <You know? laughs> Okay. But, you know, our ego loves that visualization. Doesn't it? You know, we can play that over and over again. They're finally going to apologize. But, you know, what's the chance of that happening? Yeah, 0 - 5. It's not going to happen. Okay. So if that's not going to happen, what is the use of me holding a grudge? What is the use for me wanting somebody to rot in hell? What purpose is it? You know, I'm creating the cause for me to rot in hell when I think like that. Okay? So this whole process of transforming the relationship, yeah, is very, very important. Very, very important. And when you do it, you feel so light and so free inside. When you put down that anger, you know, it's like a 2-ton weight has been lifted from your heart. When you put down that mind that you know, ripped somebody off out of greed and made up a lot of excuses to validate it, when you finally get honest about that and say, I did something wrong and I want these people to be happy and not suffer because of my actions, you know, when we finally get honest, we put down, you know, 2 tons of weight on our heart.
Is it fair or reasonable to say if you had an interaction and you felt wrong by it and you came back later to have a discussion about it?
Yeah, that's fine.
But not necessarily, you know, as a form of releasing that anger?
Not as a form of releasing that anger. Okay? But if you felt that an interaction was damaging, I think it's good to go and try and talk with the other person about it. At the Abbey, we've been doing some study of nonviolent communication. Some of you may be familiar with it, Marshall Rosenberg. And what he would say in that situation is to get in touch with our feeling, let's say, of anger. And then to ask ourselves, what is my need? I'm feeling anger, but what is it I need right now? And in doing this at the Abbey, we've realized that very often we are out of touch with what we need, with what our heart is really wanting. We're so stuck in the anger that we're not really clear on what we need to right the situation. A lot of times in situations with anger, yeah, what we're really wanting is to connect to the other person, and we're feeling frustrated because we don't know how to connect with them at that moment. Yeah. That woman with her brother, yeah, she loves her brother. What she wants to do is to be able to connect with him and see that soft, vulnerable part of him and help him through whatever agony he was going through that led him to do this abuse. That's what she's really wanting in her heart. No? But we're so often out of touch with what it is that we're really wanting that we act out of anger or neglect or whatever. So in the NVC, the nonviolent communication, you spend some time figuring out what your need is. And then you also try giving yourself some empathy. Yeah. Instead of giving your power away of, I can't do anything until they apologize, give yourself some empathy, you know, like, oh, I just had an interaction with somebody that I really care about, and I don't know what was going on in their mind, but I interpreted what they did as something harmful. And really, I want to connect with them. Yeah. And I want to have a peaceful relationship. You know, and kind of give yourself some understanding about it. You know, oh, they said something that I didn't expect at all, and I was quite taken aback and upset by it, you know. But there is a way to work with this, okay? So you give yourself some empathy, which in Buddhist language would mean practicing patience, practicing fortitude, applying one of the antidotes to anger, you know, to help ease your mind, okay? And then to go to the person and say, yeah. And here's another thing that we found very difficult, that when you talk to the person and even when you talk to yourself, you have to describe the situation without any judgment, which is very difficult to do because we're likely to go to that person and say to them, when you called me a name and put me down, you were being very disrespectful, and I'm angry about it. Okay? That kind of thing is very full of judgment and interpretation, isn't it? Yeah? We're imputing disrespect. We're imputing, you know, that they were putting us down and criticizing us. What's very interesting is to try and describe the situation to ourselves in a neutral tone without all of our interpretation about what was happening. Okay. So here's this person who came to me. Yeah. And said, I was, you know, I expected you to buy the peanut butter that we need, and you didn't go to the store to buy the peanut butter. Because lots of family fights start over something small like this. Don't they? Yeah. So the person just said to me that I didn't buy the peanut butter, and they were hoping there would be peanut butter. Fair enough, I didn't buy the peanut butter. Yeah? Okay. And so trying to, you know, take out the thing of, you know, they're disrespecting me, they're putting me down, they're obliterating me, and just look at the raw data, the raw sense data of what happened. And then we can begin to see how much interpretation we put on top of that raw sense data. Yeah? They were speaking loudly. That means they're angry and blaming me. That means they're deliberately trying to hurt me. That means that I have every right in the world to want to hurt them back. That means I should be angry because otherwise they're going to stomp all over me and my therapist is going to tell me that I'm not strong enough. So I need to be angry at this person. Let's get my anger up. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, we can begin to see the layers of conceptual overlay that we put on a situation. Yeah. In Buddhism, the term for that is inappropriate attention. Sulmanyiche is the Tibetan for it. It's a mental factor that focuses on something in the completely wrong way. Yeah, it's the creative writing part of our mind that makes up stories. And then on the basis of that, we believe the stories and we generate whatever emotion that we generate, thinking that how we feel is the only possible way anybody in their right mind could feel. When somebody says this to me, the only thing I have no choice in my reaction. I have no choice in my emotional state. I must feel angry. This is, you know, this is an assumption at a very subtle level in our mind. That when somebody speaks to me like this, I have to be angry. And then, of course, we all show our anger in different words. Some people explode, some people implode. Okay. So how we show our anger is different, but we think, now, this is the only possible way. Is that true? That we have no choice in our emotional states? There's no choice? We have to respond in a certain way? If that's true, then there's no use trying to do anything. No, then it's impossible to change our lives. Impossible. Okay. But we do have choice. And I assume that's kind of why we all came to the Dharma, is we're looking for where's that space. You know, I'm having a push-button response, you know, an action-reaction within a split second. Where's that space in between what somebody does and how I respond, and how can I make that space better, bigger, and how can I understand what's really going on in that space so that I'm not so reactive all the time? Yeah, because it's a drag to be reactive and to be under the control of my afflictions. Yeah. Okay, so we're looking for that space, and so that's what I'm talking about right now. That space, trying to look at the situation, just describe the raw sense data, take the judgment out of it. Then, you know, look at all the interpretation we're adding on to it of, you know, what that person means, the interpretation of why they did it. Yeah. Then look at all of our assumptions about how we must feel in response to what they did. Yeah. And look at all of that and see how you have one tiny stimulus here. And by the time it gets to here, it's totally into some other realm altogether. You know, coming out of our own mind. We're hallucinating. Without drugs. Yeah, we're living in hallucination. Okay? And so then when you begin to see that process and work with it and your mind develops some understanding and some calm, then it can be very helpful to go and talk to the other person and really try and listen to what they're feeling and what they're needing. Yeah. Are you feeling angry because you need to be able to trust me that when you ask me to do something, I'll do it? Or, you know, are you feeling angry, you know, because there's no peanut butter? Because, you know, try and figure out why. You know, why they might be angry. Because you were, you know, you really like peanut butter and you had a hard day at work and looking forward to coming home and having a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And there was no peanut butter. Is that why you were angry? Yeah. And so then giving that person some empathy and some understanding. Yeah. Having some compassion towards them. Okay. And then in that process, yeah, of doing that, then sometimes somebody may get more of an idea about what their own harmful emotions were and start to talk about them. And if they do, good. If they don't, it doesn't matter, because as soon as you offer empathy and kindness and compassion and understanding, usually the other person's mind changes. Because isn't that what all of us want? It's for somebody to understand.
Handle that when you know, you do that, you say, okay, I obviously did something wrong, and you have a way you work where you both, one of you attacks, the other one retaliates, you do this back and forth, and then what happens when one person stops doing that and tries to flip it around But then the other person gets even more
angry. Yes.
You know, don't lay any stupid Buddha crap on me.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Yeah, right.
So what happens when you're to reconcile the situation and really, you know, and do what you're saying completely backfires, and they get so much more angry than they were before.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't
know what to do. Okay. So, yeah, people, you know, get into this. There's a few things going on. Sometimes people really enjoy fighting. There's some people who really enjoy a good argument. I'm not one of them, but I've been in relationships with people who are, you know, and that can be difficult. Another thing is, especially in a close relationship, when people have a dynamic going. Yeah, you see this all the time in families. Yeah. You know, this one fights with this one teases that one, this one feels hurt by what that one said. Every Thanksgiving dinner, it's a rerun. Okay. But I'm joking. Maybe. but, you know, it's like that. People have a dynamic going. When one person stops their role, it throws the whole thing askew. The other person cannot keep doing what they're doing. Sometimes it stops that person in their shoes, and they start calming down and realizing, oh, I don't need to be so upset. Other times, people get more angry, you know, because at that moment, their way of engaging is through arguing. What I think is good is, in a situation of an argument, don't put your Buddha crap on somebody, okay? Don't start preaching Dharma to them. Yeah, okay, yeah. But you try in your own heart to do something, you know, to calm yourself. But then just say, you know, to the other person, are you angry? Yeah, you bet I'm angry. Are you angry because, and just make a guess of why they may be angry. And then they may say, yeah, that's why I'm angry. And you did blah, 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 blah. And you just listen to it, because what they say about you has nothing to do with you. Yeah, let them vent. Don't take it personally. Don't take it in. Yeah. And then you say, and then you pick up on something they said during that time. You said, oh, it sounds like, you know, were you really hurt because you needed, you know, some help at that time, and you know, there was nobody to help, or not that was, you know, are you hurt because you needed some help at that time? And then the person may go, yeah, I really needed some help and nobody was around. But you help them get in touch with what they're feeling and what they needed. Okay? Sometimes you may say to somebody, you know, what you guess, you know, are you angry because you needed some help? And they go, no, that's not why I'm angry. I'm angry because blah. You know, and then they tell you. And then you can come back to them and, you know, based on what they say to you. Yeah. And it's nice. I mean, if you look at the NVC, it's quite helpful that way. Yeah. But it you know, it, what you're doing is giving that person your ear and your full attention. And empathizing with the fact that they're unhappy. Yeah, here's an unhappy sentient being in front of me. Yeah, and I don't need to say, look, you need to sit down and meditate, and here's this book working on anger. You know? Don't do that while they're angry. When they're not angry, leave working with anger around on the coffee table. Yeah. Okay, you had something?
It was just a comment about taking it to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
And the element that I'm sensing is necessary. It's not a head comment.
It's not a head.
It's a heart comment.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that,
yes,
that really moves it into that neutral space. It invokes the empathy.
Yeah.
And it also allows the other person to have actually what they are feeling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You know, what I'm very thoroughly convinced that in any interaction, the thing that's most important that we bring is not a technique, but it's who we are as a human being and to be able to relate to somebody as a human being. You know, whether you're in the midst of an argument or you're at a work situation or, you know, no matter you're doing palliative care or whatever it is, or spiritual counseling or therapy or whatever it is, your doctor, your computer, you know, whatever it is, the most important thing we bring to the situation is who we are as a human being, not our techniques of how to handle something, you know, because what is it that people relate to all the time? Yeah. I was having an interview with somebody, and you know, they commented, "Oh yeah, what? Why do people kind of have so much reverence for His Holiness Dalai Lama? It's not because he's an erudite Buddhist scholar; it's because he has a kind heart. That's what people resonate with. After when you resonate with that, then you say, "Okay, how did he do that?" And then you realize, oh, he's an erudite Buddhist scholar. There's something in Buddhism, you know, that isn't intellectual, but that will teach me how to work with my own mind, and I can become like him too. So that's the first power on the first page of the Sadhana. The next part is we visualize Vajrasattva. Okay, now when we visualize, some people say, I can't visualize very well. When I was describing that scene of your enemy groveling on the floor, apologizing, did you have a mental picture of that? You visualize. Okay, visualizing just means we have a mental picture of something. Yeah. If I say, think of your mother. Think of pizza. Yeah? Especially pizza. Real clear visualization. Yeah? You know what kind of pizza it is, don't you? Thin crust, thick crust. Yeah? Certain size, kind of topping. Yeah? We have visualization. We can visualize. Why is it easier to visualize pizza than Vajrasattva? The power of familiarity. Yeah, we're much more familiar with pizza. That's where we've put our mind. Yeah, since beginningless time, our mind's been in pizza. Okay, what we're trying to do is switch our mind to Vajrasattva. As we practice, yeah, then Vajrasattva becomes so much more familiar. And you can visualize Vajrasattva like this. And so that's one thing about visualization. Second thing is, at the beginning, don't worry so much about what color are those silks that he's wearing? How many jewels in the necklace? You know, don't worry about that stuff. Just get the feeling of being in the presence of an enlightened being. Yeah. Even the visualization isn't so clear. You are in the presence of an enlightened being and you have direct communication. Yeah, there's nobody else taking up their attention. You have direct communication now with Vajrasattva. Okay? And so get that that's the kind of feeling that's most important to cultivate when you're doing this practice. I'm in the presence of a holy being. And I can create a relationship with this holy being. So what do I want to say? Yeah. So, and then also when you visualize, then Vajrasattva is made of light. You know, don't think of a statue on your head. Get a headache. Think of Vajrasattva on your head, you know, made of light. Everything's radiating, completely sparkling and radiating. Okay? Okay, then you invoke the wisdom beings. So the wisdom beings are the all the Vajrasattvas in the Pure Land, all the Vajrasattvas that appear out of emptiness. When you invoke them and then absorb them into the Vajrasattva on your head, the reason for doing this is because when we visualize Vajrasattva, sometimes we think, that's just my visualization. There's not Vajrasattva really there. But when we invoke the wisdom beings from the Pure Lands, invoke them to appear out of emptiness, the emptiness of inherent existence, and then dissolve them into Vajrasattva, then we get more of a feeling like, oh, that's really Vajrasattva, not just, you know, my visualization. Okay, then we call forth the empowering deities. So we imagine the Dhyani Buddhas coming with vases, and they give us empowerment. They come, and we make offerings to them, and then they pour the light, the nectar, you know, into the Vajrasattva on our head, and it fills him up with bliss. Okay, and then on top of Vajrasattva's head, you know, the extra nectar becomes a little akshobhya. Okay, and then you really focus on the moon disc at Vajrasattva's heart with the syllable hum. You remind yourself that it's there surrounded by the mantra. Okay, so the hum, it's a flat moon disc like this, radiant. The hum is standing upright, facing front, and then starting at the front, going this way, clockwise, you know, Om Vajrasattva Samaya, and the letters are all standing up. Okay? Okay, then we make the mandala offering, offering the whole universe to Vajrasattva. And we also make the praise to Vajrasattva. Yeah?
Can I ask a couple questions about the visualization?
Yeah.
One is the lotus on your head or above your head?
You can do it either way. You know, it can either be right on your head, it can be an inch on your above your head, it can be 4 inches above your head. Yeah, don't worry about it.
Okay. And then the empowering deities, do they then dissolve into Vajrasattva?
Yeah, right.
Okay. And is that, so the nectar that goes into you is white, but what about the nectar that's going into
Vajrasattva, also white.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a little premature or naive from my side. But it seems like, as I've been taught a lot of stuff, everything's from our mind.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing these visualizations, and then at the end here, the power of determination, Vajrasattva completely cleanses and purifies our obscurations. So it seems like it's a little Judeo-Christian where there's somebody that's taking care of my aspirations.
Okay.
Having a hard time with that.
Okay. Yeah, so it sounds a little bit like, you know, Saint Vajrasattva is is going to purify you. Yeah. Okay. You have to remember that when you're doing the visualization, where did Vajrasattva come from? Yeah, Vajrasattva is coming from your mind. Within the space of the emptiness of true existence, Vajrasattva is appearing. Okay? So you're projecting Vajrasattva outward in the usual way that we project friend, enemy, and stranger. And then we do our trips. We do our sadhana with our friend. We do our sadhana with our enemy. It's true, isn't it? Yeah? My friend sadhana, this is, you know, what you say to me, what I say to you, what I request you and I praise you. And then you do this to me and I feel good. And at the end, you know, okay? And with my enemy sadhana, you know, I project my enemy. This person is horrible and destructive and this and that. And so then my praise is, you go to hell. And, you know, my offering is fire and brimstone and cruel words. And they respond to me by throwing it all back at me. You know, it's just, it's our sadhana. Okay, we are creatures of habit. And this is all projected from our mind. You think the enemy is out there real. It's not. We think our lover is out there, an inherently wonderful, beautiful person that we can't live without, objectively existing out there, that I don't want to ever separate from. That's total hallucination. Everybody else on the planet is doing fine without that person. And you have, you know? And you're saying there, I can't live without them. They are my entire life. If they were objectively as wonderful as you're projecting, everybody would feel the same way. But everybody, as other people go, who's this guy? You know, what does she see in him anyway? Yeah? So it's, all this stuff is coming from our mind. Friend, enemy, stranger is all projection of our mind. We think it's subjective. So here we're using the same mechanism, except instead of projecting an enemy that we do our anger sadhana with, or projecting our friend that we do our attachment sadhana with, or projecting a stranger that we do our ignorance sadhana with, we're projecting Vajrasattva and do our purification sadhana. Okay? So Vajrasattva is coming from our own mind. We do the whole thing. Vajrasattva is our own future Buddha that we're going to become. It's not Saint Vajrasattva that the Dalai Lama, you know, what does the Pope do, you know, kind of put the seal on and canonize, you know? The Dalai Lama didn't, or the Buddha didn't canonize Saint Vajrasattva. You know, Vajrasattva is a projection of our own innate purity that we're trying to get in touch with. Okay? So our future Buddha, you know, the purity of our own mind, Vajrasattva is the mind that doesn't make trips. What a relief. Okay? So we do our sadhana with Vajrasattva. And at the end, when Vajrasattva says, you know, it's all, you know, all your obscurations are done with, then we feel, okay, it's all done with. Now, have you ever noticed in your life that you really know what you need to do inside, but you can't do it until you hear somebody else tell you that it's okay to do that? Yeah? Have you ever seen that in your life? That you know through your own wisdom, but it's so helpful when somebody else says that. Okay, so here it's the same thing. You've confessed, you've purified, you've changed your attitude. You know you've purified, but it's so helpful when Vajrasattva says, you've purified. So helpful. Oh, yeah, I have purified. And then Vajrasattva doesn't just walk away. Vajrasattva dissolves into emptiness and comes and unites with your own heart, comes back into your own mind. Your mind and Vajrasattva become unified. Okay? So it's not a Judaic Christian external being that you have to please and propitiate. This is a skillful mean to work with our own mind. Okay? Making some sense? Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because most of us come to Buddhism, if we weren't raised Buddhists, we come with things from our religion of origin. And it comes up in all sorts of ways, like this. And it's important to really investigate and ask.
So are there purification practices that you know that don't involve visualizations, that are more just sort of mindfulness or going over your day and still going through the four R's, that kind of more unified without the visualization or absorption?
You know, if because the visualization and absorption and mantra recitation, that's the power of remedial action. If instead of doing that, you want to offer service, let's say at a charity or offer service at the Dharma Center or make offerings or, you know, do some acts of kindness, do some volunteer work somewhere, that's great. Or, you know, read a Dharma book or... you know, do some meditation on another Dharma topic, all of that becomes the power of the antidote. Yeah? Okay, this will be the last question. Yeah.
In the visualization, there's a description of Bodhisattva and consort with six-syllable corresponding to the body, speech, and mind. And my question is, when the Bodhisattva and consort become inseparable, is there one seat syllable, or do they maintain?
Oh, well, both figures have their seed syllable and the mantra at their heart. Okay, when they dissolve into light, both of them dissolve together and come into you.
So when the mantra syllables are turning around.
The mantra symbols aren't turning; they're stationary. They're in each figure, yeah, the male and the female, both of them have the moon at their heart with the hung with the mantra around it, and the light and nectar that purifies you comes from both of them. Okay, let's dedicate. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Vajrasattva, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi Maya born arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. So there will be the meditation session. Then after meditation session, offer your lunch and eat your fill at lunch and finish by 1 o'clock. And then after that, then there's no solid food for the rest of the day, but you can have beverages.